Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the New Statesman podcast with editor Jason Cowley, politics editor George Eaton and philosopher and New Statesman contributor John Gray.
Hello, I'm Jason Cowley, editor of the New Statesman. I'm delighted to say that with me is one of our favourite writers, John Gray, the philosopher, author and New Statesman's lead book reviewer. And I also have our political editor, George Eaton, with me. John, a few weeks ago, you wrote an essay in The Statesman about Ed Miliband, his worldview,
right,
his policies, which in the jargon of the internet travelled. A lot of people read it, had great uptake online. And you, your central thesis, if I can call it that, was that in some way, some fundamental way, Miliband misunderstands the present.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that and what you meant by that?
Yes, Jason. I mean, I think Miliband has positioned himself according to the view, which is his genuine reading of the present condition of British politics, on the basis of the belief that we're now in a situation akin to that in the mid-1970s,
yeah,
or the late 1970s, when an old political consensus was disintegrating and a new one was emerging. In other words, a time in which voters were ready for a radical shift in orientation. Now, I think that view is historically, that analogy between the mid to late 70s and our present situation doesn't really hold water. Because there are many fundamental differences between then and now, but one is a much greater degree of globalization has altered the situation in Britain, but also I think the British population as a whole doesn't regard the existing type of capitalism as one whose future is in fundamental doubt, which in the mid-70s and the late 70s, remember when we had inflation for a while at 27% annually and three-day week, tremendous industrial conflict and so on, there was a period of profound doubt and anxiety. At the moment, British voters, as they look around the world, will see many conflicts, they'll see the Eurozone struggling, they'll see wars and upheavals in many parts of the world, but they don't have the deep-seated belief that this type of capitalism is so flawed that it could mutate into something else. And they certainly don't believe, it seems to me, as Ed Miliband seems to do, that Britain is in a position in the world to craft or fashion a new type of capitalism, a new type of non-predatory capitalism, he sometimes talks about.
Because he's made the distinction between predator and responsible capitalism.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure that can be made even.
John, Ed, what Miliband would say and where he draws comparison with the Thatcher period. I mean, he says his ambition is Thatcheresque.
Mm. He has said that, hasn't he?
He has said that. Well, you have the unravelling of the post-war Keynesian
yes.
consensus
yes.
At the beginning of the mid-70s and then onwards.
Yeah.
He would say we're seeing the financial crisis signalled the end of the kind of neoliberal, 30-year neoliberal experiment.
Mm.
You think he's deluded to say that?
I think
you yourself, of all people, you forecast the curve.
Yes, but it hasn't. The paradox of the financial crisis, which I did forecast, is that it hasn't actually shaken the neoliberal consensus as much as one thinks it would have done. But there's another aspect to Ed's misjudgment here, which is that although he says this, he hasn't actually come up with any alternative view of capitalism in any detail or any structural or disciplined way. What he's come up with is a variety of policies on the margins.
Yes.
Which actually...
So it's incrementalism.
Yeah, it's a type of incrementalism. It's not really... I mean, in the 80s, what happened was that ideas which had been bubbling up in the 70s filtered through into ideas from Hayek and a number of other people, Friedman and others, which had been around for a while, but bubbled up through the Conservative Party, got then embodied in Margaret Thatcher, who to begin with was pretty much of a blank slate, mm-hmm. actually. They were implemented, and there was a fundamental disjunction. It was a fundamentally, not new intellectually, but politically, it did represent a new era. But there's no sign of that. And I think one of the reasons...
So you're talking about...
In Ed's talk, one of the reasons the voters are, many voters are rather leery of it, is that they hear this big talk about it.
Yes.
And but actually there's not any substance to it. As whether or not you think it was a disaster or whether you think it was necessary, Thatcherism did represent a real shift.
Mm. It was a profound change.
A profound and real change.
And an
enduring one.
An enduring one. An unleashing of the markets, yes. controlling inflation, abolition yes. of credit controls, and so on and so
yes.
forth. Accompanied alongside that was a very robust foreign policy.
Yes.
Anti-Soviet, yes. Atlanticist,
yes.
and Eurosceptic ultimately. So you had a domestic policy and a foreign
yes.
policy.
And an interesting gap in all of Ed Miliband's thinking is that it's extremely insular.
Mm.
We hear very little about foreign policy. He intervened, it's true, in the case of the possible Syria action by the British state, but it's not clear that that was part of any larger vision.
Yeah, it was more unintended consequences.
It was an unintended consequence of other things he wanted to do. It was interesting in the exchanges he had with, that Ed Miliband had with Paxman the other evening,
mm-hmm.
that at no point was foreign policy ever even mentioned. If you think of the scale of his intellectual ambition, or the way, or if you think of how dauntingly formidable is his self-image as someone, a leader who could alter the course of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
that's a big gap, because what it leaves out is how relatively small the leverage of a country, a mid-level country like Britain, is now. Certainly, because of the vast increase in globalization since the mid-1970s, we've got much less leeway than we had then.
Mm, sure. So from what you're saying is he just fundamentally misguided, or is it that he's not ambitious enough?
I think he's misguided as to what the electorate really wants. I don't find what the electorate seemed to me to want is not some move away from the type of capitalism we now have, although many of them will perhaps feel that it's generated inequalities on too large a scale.
Mm.
They may that in that sense it's unfair. But what seems that many do want is, first of all, for that capitalism to deliver the goods more successfully, but also perhaps that the rampant marketization of public services, including the health service, really has been a misstep. And in this respect, perhaps he is insufficiently ambitious, because there's no evidence really, although who really believes that if Miliband comes to power, which is still feasible after the general election, a minority government of some kind propped up by the SNP, what evidence is there that what reason do we have for thinking that the marketization of the National Health Service would actually be reversed rather than maybe slowed down or arrested in some way? And yet I tend to think that at the back of many people's minds, whoever they vote for at the moment, is an idea in which you have some version of our present capitalist system, but buffered by genuine market non-institutions.
Mm.
There's nothing of that. Mm. Although he says he's moved on from New Labour, he accepts the whole inheritance of marketization that Blair brought about. There's no evidence. He, to my knowledge, he's never made a commitment against it in terms of rolling back any of that. So it's kind of paradoxical. On the one hand, I think he's his political vision is sort of vague and indeterminate and indefinite, and also kind of unrealizable and unrealistic, given Britain's position in the world about having a different kind of capitalism in this country. But in other respects, where perhaps something could be done, it's not ambitious enough.
Mm. And is it also a warning to the left that when we're in an era of globalization and capital is so mobile and the rich are so adept at avoiding taxation altogether, that it's very difficult to create social democracy in one country. I mean, is there optimism? Should one be optimistic for the prospects of the left, a leftist transformation?
I don't. Well, I mean, in a sense, the question you're asking could be applied to a thinker that Miliband and his circle took up, Piketty.
Yeah.
Now, if you read Piketty's book, he says this can only be dealt
with. His book, Capital.
His book, Capital in the 21st Century. Piketty says these issues can only be dealt with at the global level.
Yes.
Now, one of the sort of interesting things is who's going to deal with them at the global level?
Transnational institutions, which ones?
And which transnational institution is going to tell the Chinese what to do?
Absolutely.
Look here, you've got far too high inequalities in Beijing at the moment. This is what you. So it's nonsense. When you have a world with big powers, some of them don't give a toss what the Western powers think, there's no possibility of a global redistributional project. And even at the level of Europe, is it feasible, given the problems of the Eurozone, that any European institution could actually, they can't achieve fiscal harmonization. They haven't even achieved that yet. So I think that sets a limit on what the left can do. It doesn't mean it can do nothing, because they can still consider, so to speak, rebuilding non-market institutions outside. They can still think of doing that in various fields. And yet, oddly, very few of them think of that. They accept this enormous marketization of education, of healthcare, for example. They may express, say, it's gone slightly too far, but there's never any consideration of the possibility of rebuilding important non-market institutions, and that could be done.
George, you obviously follow Westminster day-to-day very carefully, what's going on there, who's saying what to whom. Is there a sense inside the Miliband camp that they've misunderstood the present? Because Ed is resilient, and also, as we saw last night in the in his exchanges with Paxman and with the audience, he has extraordinary self-confidence. He may be deluded, but he nevertheless has that confidence. What's your sense? Do they feel something new, something transformative is possible?
I don't know if they'd necessarily use the word transformative, but they do feel they have a radical programme. And one difficulty I think they feel is that the bar is continually being raised. So under New Labour, something like a mansion tax would have been unthinkable. The top rate of tax was fixed at 40p. It was only raised to 50p after the crisis.
You know, Ed Miliband. Why, Alistair Darling.
Yeah. And Ed Miliband is now saying we'd take it back up to 50p. We'd introduce a mansion tax on properties worth more than 2 million.
But will this yield much return?
No, but they see it as a sign of his commitment to redistribution and to approaching inequality in a way that would have been unthinkable under New Labour. But that's now seen as fairly moderate, because the debate has shifted in that sense, that we can have, I mean, almost the fact that you can have a discussion and a debate around Ed Miliband and capitalism shows how the debate has moved on from the New Labour period. I think the difficulty has been this misalignment between some of his rhetoric and some of his policies. Yes. That I think had he spoken as a moderate social democrat from the start, had he been quite clear that this was just about making capitalism better, rather than using terms like Thatcheresque, then I think
a different kind of capitalism.
Yes, then I think some of those contradictions that you and John were alluding to wouldn't have been so present. And interestingly, in a recent interview, he said, look, I think I have got a radical programme. I think if you save the NHS, I think if you deal with zero-hours contracts, if you raise the minimum wage, if you introduce the mansion tax, if you build 200,000 homes a year, then I think you're in business.
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That's not nothing.
It's interesting that he's now speaking in those terms.
And not talking about a new
rather than talking about a new capitalism.
Yeah. That was an error, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, John, is that in a sense he's being more pragmatic, or is it a sense of retreat on his part?
It's probably both, because he's still, I mean, on the one hand, he's toning down this wild and kind of unreal rhetoric about a new type of capitalism, and putting forward a variety of proposals which would amount to something if you could achieve them. But on the other hand, it could reasonably be argued by that, and there would be, I'm not a blue Labour person. I think that in many ways that's a kind of reactionary utopia, but it could be argued that, you know, there are areas in which the market has been artificially projected through state institutions in ways that haven't worked terribly well. I mean, is it really the case that the existing NHS, which is already extensive, is it really more efficient? Is it really more sensitive to need? Does it really work better? Or is it more unintelligible? Is it more managerially deformed than it was before? I mean, was it the case, I'm not saying we can go back to the old pre-market NHS, but would something like the mid-staff's deaths, did they ever occur then? The large number of deaths did that actually happen in those times? We have no evidence that it ever did. So, you know, what is it about this new type of, whereby it's actually dysfunctional? So there is room in public services for a more radical criticism. Mm-hmm. So he's got this kind of paradox which runs right the way through him. He's tactically very ruthless. Strategically, he's been highly conservative, and rhetorically, mellifluously utopian. And so if he could have been more consistent all along, and that might have removed some of the difficulty. But maybe it's not in his nature to be like that, because he has a tendency to emphasize the pragmatic aspects when he's under criticism. Mm. But he does seem to have a Thatcher-esque self-image.
Yeah, he does. And also, John, I thought John captured two things well there. I mean, Ed Miliband is ruthless. There's no doubt about it. And he's extremely ambitious. Mm.
Yeah.
And has unbelievable self-belief. I mean, from my encounters with him.
Incredibly robust, for one thing.
Incredibly robust. And he has this, I think, and from many conversations with him, and I've grown increasingly sceptical about him, as you know, is this sense of manifest destiny.
Yes.
And he is destined to be Prime Minister and to lead the country in a new direction. Mm. That's what he believes.
Mm. But it's interesting, that one point that came out from the debates is people say, oh, he is quite tough, he's quite resilient.
He's very tough.
A theme. But we shouldn't be surprised that a son of Ralph Miliband, someone who worked for Gordon Brown, someone who defeated his brother in a leadership contest, has those characteristics. It's not surprising.
Yes, he may not be nimble in the House, as we saw on Wednesday when he was smashed at PMQs by Cameron, but it doesn't mean he's not tough, because he's not nimble and not fluent in the way that Cameron
doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that there won't be circumstances in which he gets for a while part of what he wanted, namely being Prime Minister,
even if he doesn't last for long.
Even if he doesn't last for long, as I speculated in my piece for you, Jason, in The New Statesman, and even if he's heavily in debt, as he would be, to the SNP. So actually, whatever vision he had, or even whatever particular proposals he had, would be to some extent forfeit to their demands, because even the more pragmatic ones would have to be paid for. But if he has to make large concessions to Scottish needs first, as a precondition of staying in power, then these other pragmatic proposals will also be compromised, won't they? Or at least endangered.
To wrap up, and it's great to have you with us, John, today. You've been
great to be here.
Very prescient on the financial crisis and much else. We could be entering a period of great turbulence if we're not already there. If there's a Cameron minority government, we have an in-out referendum on the EU. The British Union is as fragile as it's ever been, and no doubt soon there'll be a second referendum. What do you sense lies ahead? I mean, even perhaps, I know you're a Eurosceptic at heart. Can you see not only the British Union, but the European Union both coming apart?
Not in the next few years.
Not in the short term.
Jason, because my sort of intuition is that if Cameron gets into a position in which he can have an in-out referendum soon, 2016 or 2017. He's talked about it in 2016 on occasion. My intuition is that and I said this in the piece I wrote for you, Jason, is that the underlying mood of the British people is that the situation is not bad enough in Britain to warrant what they would see as a leap in the dark. Mm. So the confidence of Farage that there is this vast groundswell of frustrated Eurosceptic is illusory. Mm. Is illusory. We've, comparatively speaking, flourished on the margins. Being half in and half out has worked has worked rather
well. What George Soros said today.
Yes, yes. What George Soros. So it's worked very well. Why not continue for a while? The basic policy would be wait and see. I mean, if the EU cracks up, disintegrates because of Greece or some other reason, or another possibility which would be truly revolutionary, I don't predict it, but I think it's realistically now thinkable, a Marine Le Pen presidency. Mm. If that were to happen, so that would throw the whole thing up like
unlikely because of the French voting system.
It's unlikely,
she'd have to
yeah.
win the runoff.
Yeah, but she could have a much bigger impact on, probably will, on French national politics. So the future for the Eurozone is not bright, but it doesn't mean it's going to break down now. And nor am I really convinced that the Union's going to break down, because, of course, unlike when the Scottish referendum was held, I mean, we've got two crucial differences. One is the collapse in the oil price, which would have rendered, if they'd won, Scotland a fiscally unviable state, actually, which would have had to be bailed out probably by the remainder of Britain, rendered the United Kingdom. But secondly, the currency question, which was a key question in that referendum, it's not been resolved, but got more difficult. Would a new Scotland really become a member of the EU? The European authorities themselves said that they wouldn't accept that until Scotland had demonstrated its credentials, the proper central bank, and all the rest of it. So we might get in. We'd be in a very paradoxical situation. First of all, in what you called in your article and interview, Jason, with Salmon. An astonishing turnaround. We now have a situation in which the most powerful swing force in British politics will be, on most scenarios, almost all I would say that are credible after the election, will be the SNP, which lost the referendum. We could look ahead to something even more astonishing, I think, which is that if there were a referendum, maybe the SNP will decide not to have one for this very reason, not to push for an early one, but for a relatively early second referendum, we could have a situation in which the SNP would have completely unchallenged domination of the Scottish political landscape and still not be able to deliver a yes vote. Because if the oil price hasn't gone back up, or if it has gone up but is wildly volatile, going up and down because of events in Yemen and elsewhere, which is quite possible, and if the situation in Europe is far from improving, has, as George Soros has speculated, right, has gotten gradually worse and worse without getting to the point of a complete breakdown, would the Scottish voters then vote to leave under those circumstances? I very much doubt it. So, in fact, there might be a kind of an element in bluff, at least in Salmon, in this idea we want a quick second referendum. Mm-hmm. He might retreat from it if it looks as if they're not going to get a clear 60%. So we'd have the ultimate paradox of the Scottish nationalists being predominant not only in England but in Scotland, but not able to get any closer to their ultimate project, except by getting ever more radical or comprehensive forms of Devo-Max.
And as this, we're 4 or 5 weeks out now from a general election, tell me if you don't want to say this, but can I draw you both out on the likely outcome of the vote in May, George, you first, and John?
Yeah, I think Labour will be the largest party, with the SNP holding the balance of power in hung parliament. I mean, the Tories haven't had the movement in the polls that they were hoping for. They keep having to postpone the date that the so-called crossover takes place, rather like those tribes who forecast the end of the world and have to constantly revise their predictions. Mm. So I think that will be the outcome. I mean, the real...
So that means the Miliband will be Prime Minister?
It does. And the real hurdle for Cameron is that the Tories and their allies, the DUP and the Lib Dems, now need to ensure that they have a majority between them. If Labour and the SNP have a majority between them, then, as Alex Salmond indicated in his interview with you recently, it's impossible for Cameron to survive as Prime Minister. I think that has potentially changed the game.
Yeah. Is that your sense too?
I think I would come very close to that. I mean, one of the reasons why that's plausible is UKIP's not going to break through.
No.
They might have a couple of seats, maybe three if they're tremendously lucky, but the real players on the Conservative side would be the DUP and maybe the Liberals, if there's anything much left of them. And if, I mean, the other day, David Steele said, you know, do we want, if there are half of us are removed, do we want to do it again and reduce ourselves by another half? You know, are they really willing to do that? Will there not be a revolt against Clegg's leadership and so on? So I think it's still feasible, it's still conceivable to me that I mean, the electoral arithmetic is so unfathomably complicated. We've never had a four or five party competition against the background of a coalition government. So we don't know. It's possible that Cameron could, with the constitutional uncertainties of he's still in office and recommended by senior civil servants, that he should try and form a government. It's possible that he could try. But how long would he really hang on? He looks like a goner now, doesn't he? Even though, I mean, he was talking in this vainglorious way of, I'll only serve another 5 years. I mean, he's almost, you know, that will go down as one of the great one-line mistakes in British politics, because the objective situation is that he's resented profoundly in the party for not winning, even against Gordon Brown. If in this situation, against a leader, Ed Miliband, who's been regarded by them as even more unpopular and even less qualified to be Prime Minister, then I think Cameron's had it. So then you'll have kind of conflict along, but much earlier than he anticipated in his comments on this. You'll have a kind of an almost immediate conflict, I would think. Don't you think?
Because he will invariably disappoint them again, because in the absence of a Tory majority, you're not going to be able to give the Tory right the real red meat they seek.
Yes.
And they like the idea of a minority government, but unless you can win the majority of the House to your side, you're not going to be able to seriously.
You can't do what the sizable element of neo-Thatcherites in the party want him to do.
Yeah.
And he's not going to be able to do that. So I think he'll turn out to be an ephemeral figure.
Okay. I'll take the fifth for now. I won't give you my view on what I think will happen, but I might be tempted at some time. Brilliant to have you here, John Gray. Always
a pleasure.
I
really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Jason.
George Eaton, thank you very
much.
And thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Anoush Shekelian, and produced by Anna Leskovich. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music was Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.